The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. The book Color, Facture, Art, and Design is the topic this week, as author Iona Singh joins me to discuss constructivism, materialism, and Marx. Iona, as well as being a Zero Books author, is an artist. Those are her paintings on the cover for this week's show. It's Wednesday, April 13th, 2016, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. Last week, I mentioned and linked to an essay by Brendan O'Neill at Spite and asked that people reach out to me, either through comments or by email or by Facebook. I received a couple of emails back, one from Vinny in New Zealand, who said he'd been listening to the podcast for a while and who rightly accused me of wanting to be Mark Maron. I also received some comments on the O'Neill piece. Mostly people didn't like it and don't like O'Neill. I would just like to point out that while the rich and the powerful don't deserve any sympathy, there is a danger in getting too invested in the latest charges of corruption. Namely, the danger is this will revive a dream of a functional capitalism that manages to produce something like social equality. The music in this episode includes a piece called The Radio of the Future, a condensed explanation of Kant's aesthetics, an excerpt from the Board of Canada's song Aquarius, and a history of the color blue. The music you're listening to right now is from the short film Suprematism in Our Life. And in just a moment, you'll be listening to Iona Singh and I discuss color and form. Iona Singh is an author and journalist specializing in art and design, specifically in the realms of art and design materials. She is also the author of refereed essays published in academic journals in the United States in Rethinking Marxism and the eco-journal Capitalism, Nature, and Socialism. Her book, Color, Fracture, Art, and Design, was published by Zero Books in 2012. Iona Singh, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Doug.
I want to actually start our conversation by telling you about something I did recently. I went to the Pacific Northwest College of Art and gave a presentation on the critique of the Gotha program and Adorno's culture industry chapter from his Negative Dialectics. My thought is that people on the left need to rethink the connection between the base and the superstructure or economy and ideology. We've gotten sidetracked, I think, by focusing most of our critique on the ideological side. And so your book was really of interest to me because you seem to be tackling that very problem.
I think that's correct. It's looking at art from the point of view, I think, of feelings and of the sensual. That's the sort of basis of it. Mm-hmm. It's looking at art history and the way that art history is generally and has generally been, which is quite based in the sort of narrative and the figurative and symbolism and even the historical context, all things that are to do with the sort of figurative aspect of art and not really to do with the sensual aspect of it, I think. And this is also true from a different perspective. When these art historians talk about, they start eulogising about the work of art, and they'll talk about it from the point of view of fantastic and a marvellous, wonderful, but they don't actually explain what they mean by that or where these fantastic things come from. So therefore, the art is left open as something that is sort of transcendent and, you know, from God, and you're still going back to this old-fashioned... And I think that's, as you're saying, that's the point of focusing too much really on ideology. It's not really dealing with the sensual enough to become really materialist. And if you don't do that, there's going to be lots of problems from the point of view of materialism and Marxism, I think.
The subtitle of your book is How is Technique Political? So right there, you're focusing on the physical act of, and maybe not only the physical act, but also the ideas that divide up a canvas or the different approaches to painting as technique. But you're not talking about, say, the content of paintings.
Yeah, it's really. I mean, there's so much history of art that is so. I mean, it's pretty good, and it goes into the content, even, you know, from a sort of more kind of left point of view, the historical context and content. Mm-hmm. And this is an attempt to really move away from that and look at the way feelings and sort of how art will sort of stimulate the body from that point of view. And for me, for this project, there's two relevant sort of issues. And the first one is to look at the materials and technique of the production of the work of art. That was the first thing. And then also to look at the actual sort of body of the viewer, because the viewer is a sort of physical, material, you know, object and sort of sensual object. So it's really the combination of the materials and technique and how that comes together with perception.
When I reread the critique of the Gotha program, especially the beginning of that essay where he was talking about the significance of nature, which is, I think, connected to the significance of the sensual, or in Marx's terms, the importance of use values, maybe even. That he wanted to make a very strong point that at that point he was, you know, critiquing the Gotha program to other German socialists, that it was not just our human labor that created value or wealth, specifically wealth in the world, but also nature, that in fact the foundation of all wealth was nature. But he did that in order to point out that we don't start as equals, even in our human labor, that in fact, some people have access to nature through property relations and some people don't. And that was very important for Marx in the Critique of the Gotha program to say, you know, the significant thing about human labor under capitalism isn't only that some people have the products of their labor taken away from them, but also that they don't have control over what they produce. They don't have any access to nature except through an exploitive relationship. And so he wanted to underline what actually was an ideological relationship, but that property relationship, even as he spoke about nature. Do you take a similar approach to in the world of art?
For a start, I mean, even bringing in this term that you're using, you know, and that Marx uses, nature, well, and, you know, the physical relationship to nature, it's definitely, it's just left out. I'm talking about my subject, you know, art history and art theory. It just doesn't exist. It doesn't exist in it. So even though I don't want to really criticise them, kind of even some Marxist kind of theorists, but they don't actually go this route. Nobody seems to talk about it very much. So I think it's really just trying to point out this relationship of nature through art and through the materials the artist is using. You know, the artist has his materials. The materials come from nature, as everything does, and the artist will pick his materials from nature and... Of course, it's he has knowledge, he'll have a lot of skill and knowledge and everything. He'll arrange these materials to make these sort of artistic objects. Those objects are like kind of intensified nature. He'll choose the colour relations, he'll choose the materials, he'll set them all out to stimulate people, you know. I mean, as soon as you start talking about nature in this way, you're then talking about aesthetic, and the term aesthetic is no longer this sort of Kantian, you know, the old-fashioned transcendental term of an aesthetic. You're coming to a sort of material aesthetic. So it shifts all those things. You know, as soon as you start to bring in this just the conception of nature, art, you know, materials and sort of substances, it opens the doors to so much more, a much better analysis, I think, anyway.
What was Kant's definition of aesthetic again, just to...
Well, I mean, it's, you know, I'm not being really specific about any particular theorist.
So, hi, my name is Douglas Walt, and I'm going to explain Immanuel Kant's 1790 philosophical masterwork, The Critique of Aesthetic Judgment, the incredible book in which he explains what beauty is, what art is, and why people like stuff. And the reason this has to be the drastically condensed, awesome version is that if you try to read Kant's actual text, it will make your brain explode. He was a great thinker and one of the very worst writers of all time. In fact, his translator actually referred to his repulsive style. Nonetheless, he manages to break down the basic experiences that through which we assess things into four kind of different categories of what he calls reflective judgments. You can say that an aesthetic experience is agreeable, or good, or beautiful, or sublime, which is this kind of weird fourth category that gets battered around a lot. But what's unusual about judgments of beauty is that they are disinterested. That means that you don't have a horse in the race. You don't care about what's being represented. You don't care about the thing itself. You can't say, you know, your house may appear beautiful to you, but that's, you have interest because it's your house. You live there. So you can't really say, if you see this picture of Wolverine, you say, this picture of Wolverine is beautiful because he's badass. And the answer is no. This picture of Wolverine is agreeable because he's badass. It's something that you personally like, but that's not a judgment of beauty. If you see this next picture of Wolverine here and you say, like, oh, this picture of Wolverine is beautiful because he's good, he's a superhero, he's fighting for what's right when all seems lost. No, that's not a judgment of beauty either. That's a judgment of moral goodness, which is something that Kant says that you can prove independently. It doesn't have anything to do with the fact that Wolverine or that he's good or any of that stuff that's being represented. However, if you see this picture of Wolverine's awesome adamantium claws and say, wow, I have no idea what this is, but I really like the composition and the color and the straight lines of that, Kant would say, yes, that's a judgment of beauty because you're judging it independent of any interest in it, independent of what content it is. Another thing he says about beauty is that it has the form of finality. So if you see something in nature or art that's beautiful, it seems to have been designed with a purpose, even though it hasn't been. There's a lot of weird little contradictions like that about beauty and Kant's estimation of what beauty is. For example, he thinks that any judgment of beauty has the appearance of being universal, even though it isn't actually universal. If you see something you think is beautiful, you think everybody has to agree with you, even though they don't, necessarily. So, for example, if you think Alina the Hyena here is, you know, the beautiful girl of the month, you want all of your friends to think, like, oh, you assume all of your friends are going to think Alina the Hyena is the beautiful girl of the month, and if they go, like, what are you talking about? You're going to think they're barely even human. So the reason that beauty works that way is that it only works in society. The way that beauty works is it's what Kant calls a sensus communis, a common sense of things. So if, for example, you think that it's the most beautiful experience in the world to have a giant alien starfish put itself over your face, you're going to want all of your friends to experience the giant alien starfish over their face either, whether they're actually going to want to or not. It's going to appear to you that that's going to be the way that people like things to be. God, I love that picture. The other thing that Kant goes into is the idea of the sublime. He says the sublime is that in comparison with which all else is small. The sublime is something that's as big as Superman, 15 times as big as the Earth. It overwhelms you. It gives you a simultaneous sense of terror and delight. Terror in that there's this thing that's so much bigger than you that you have no idea what it could possibly be, and delight that you have the mental capacity to wrap your brain around the fact that there is something that's so big that you can't possibly make any sense of it. And so what you feel like is like the human torch here going like, we're like ants, just ants, ants. And that's kind of a cool feeling, and it's also kind of a scary feeling. So that's the sublime. Sublime gets thrown around for a lot of things in art and nature, but really it has to totally overwhelm it. He says, is art that works through cognition, through thinking about it. Even though it pleases immediately, it goes to the brain instead of like, oh, yeah, that's Wolverine with an ear. That's really kind of cool. But art, he says that fine art can't quite imitate nature itself. You can't have the idea that you're looking at a perfect imitation of nature itself, but the strange thing about art is that there's no rules for making it. Everything seems to be kind of strange about it. There's nothing that can always generate it. And one beautiful thing that art does is it can make even horrible or shocking things like beautiful or an interesting aesthetic experience. The one thing that it can't do that with is anything that's actually disgusting. So if it makes you lose your lunch, you can't aestheticize it. And what you need to produce something that's, you know, a beautiful or sublime aesthetic experience is what he calls genius, which makes your head gigantic and also means that you can make things. There are no rules for genius. There's nothing that governs it. There's no rule that says what you can always do. So in conclusion, Kant says that beauty is immediate and it has giant adamantium claws that can rip through anything. That's my Twitter if you want to argue aesthetics with me. Thanks very much.
The old style aesthetic, where you have to be quite careful using this term aesthetic, because especially if you want to be a materialist, you know, because aesthetic usually means beauty, very, very kind of an abstract thing. Maybe it's in the eye of the beholder. It's an idealist term in philosophy, I think, you know, generally in the past. But then, as you say, if you start to think of it in terms of how artists can sort of stimulate the eyes and the body of the viewer through their materials, you then are able to think of it as more of a materialist type of, you know, conception. And it's in opposition to the term anaesthetic. Anaesthetic meaning, you know, a deadening of the senses, whereas aesthetic is a sort of heightening of the senses.
So could your approach, a materialist approach to understanding the aesthetics of painting, be applied to different periods historically just as successfully because it's using the human body, which is a natural object?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is why, if you look, everybody still loves Uccello, and Uccello is really a long time ago now, you know, and everybody, and there's some, so, I mean, I think, well, and the same with Vermeer, you're thinking, well, it has to be something that's sort of a bit more long-lasting than just the ideological moment or the moment. And you're thinking, well, it's appealing to the body because the body is something that changes quite slowly. You know, change in evolution. It's not set in stone. It's not essential, but it does change. But it'll change through evolution. And it changes slowly. Therefore, the work of somebody, you know, really like a long time ago, like Duccio or Uccello, is still going to appeal to us now.
So if we want,
I think that's why they do.
So if we really wanted to change what we took to be beautiful, we'd have to maybe do some genetic engineering.
Well, it'll change in time.
Oh, yeah, we could take the slow route, but if we wanted to get our hands on the thing.
Yeah, but I mean, why would you want to do that? It'll be difficult to change all those millions of years. Yeah, okay, genetic engineering, but it's such a wonderful thing, all those millions of years of honing, you know, for us to see so many millions of colours and, you know, and the textures and this kind of thing.
Right, well, I'll put that aside. It was not a serious suggestion. So this is a way to sort of get at something foundational in the human experience, or semi-foundational. It's not unchanging, but it's this very gradual process, right? It's not even a historical process. It's a natural process of the changing of the sensual, the changing of the human body. And you're finding this as a foundation to work from, but Marx would always want to then talk about the social relations which mediate our experience of the natural.
Do you think that a Marxist would have a problem with saying that, you know, that at what point does social relations come into the natural? Because I know, for instance, we're talking now about colours and textures and all that kind of thing. Mm. Well, as I said, I think a painting like Uccello and Vermeer are still as relevant now in terms of their colour and their form as they were when they were, you know, painted.
I think they are, just to play devil's advocate, a Marxist critic might say, they are as relevant as individual objects, but they're not as relevant for the culture overall because those effects are so easily produced are much more easily produced today, given modern techniques, modern relationships, modern technology. And so while the beauty of that painting remains as an individual object, it doesn't have as much power socially as it might have had, because the image has been debased by mass production.
I think mass production of an image is totally different from an artistic image. I mean, there's absolutely no comparison. They're sort of virtually two different things. Mm-hmm. I think, and this is the point that I'm getting at, really, or, you know, is that really the important thing, as I've discussed, you know, in the chapter about Vermeer, is really the way that Vermeer uses his different layers of materials. Mm-hmm. So he's under his sort of bottom layer, his underneath layer is his ground, and then on this amazing dark, sort of really dark and thick, almost like volcanic type rock that he's used as this ground, he's painted resin with the pigment, and the resin has an effect of, you know, people go on about the crushed pearls in Vermeer's work without really explaining why it's so like crushed pearls, but in fact he used a lot of resin in it, and the resin has this sort of effect of sort of bending the light.
Mm-hmm.
One has to ask oneself the question, I mean, when you see a painting in a gallery, you know, is one succumbing to the grandiose atmosphere of the gallery, and because we've been told that Vermeer is a great, great painter, or are you actually seeing, you know, is something happening with your eyes and your body's being affected by this amazingly sort of skilled honing of colour relations? It's an expression of our own senses on an external object in an intensified way, and this is the effect of art and the huge effect of it. And for me, I'd say there is something there that's true. I think there is a value in this work of art beyond anything ideological. So I think, as you said, you're saying to me, the technology, the modern technology, you know, can do this now. I don't know any modern technology that can sort of produce works like a Vermeer.
But can you imagine that maybe in 20 years or 100 years that we would have the technology that could do the fine work using materials that were either identical to what was used then, or materials that were so close that they simulated that effect nearly perfectly? And that we could reproduce Vermeer's on a mass scale? And really, is that imaginal?
Well, I mean, the thing is, you know how many colours people can see. They can see, it could be infinite, the number of, it depends on what interpretation you go by, but people can see probably an infinite number of colours. And, you know, it's beyond 2 million anyway. And the only other thing is about that, the subtlety of that. 200 years, we might have that kind of technology. But if you think we've been here, you know, sort of evolving for how many millions of years now, and it's sort of taken all this time for us to, not only us, but all the other sort of plants and objects and things on planet Earth that we have a kind of visual and tactile and sensory interaction with, I think, that we're able to discern all these different textures and colours. And all this, it sounds to me like it's too long-term a thing and too special a thing. Again, this is what I think the artists, I think, are aware of all this and are using this in their work. And I think this is too special and too sort of advanced and long-term to be able to produce it in any technology. I mean, in the near future, but I mean, if you could, well, yeah, I mean, that's not... What if you could produce it in technology? That wouldn't be...
No, I don't think so either. But I guess what I'm asking is, originally what I was asking was, does the power of an aesthetic object come from its position as a particular unique thing, or the fact that only one or two people has the material power to create these objects, or is it in the body of the viewer where the value is?
Right, so I mean it could sound a bit like there's a few great artists and nobody, and you know they're kind of these geniuses and everybody else is kind of ordinary.
I'm not even sure.
You mean it could sound a bit like that.
What I'm really asking about is whether or not you feel that the individuality or the particularness of the painting and it is significant, or if it is it the relationship that these, or the effect, the material effect that these kinds of this light and color and pattern creates in the viewer that's important.
When you say individual, I mean, it's really the artist is representing everybody else in a way. It's the artist who is a human who can see like us and who is using that faculty, but with his skill that he has, or she has, to make these objects. I mean, so the artist is really somebody who's totally integrated with other people and is almost an extension of other people and is also an extension of nature and is kind of mediating the two. So I don't really know if there's anything particularly individual about it in some ways. You know, that's why they have such sort of, you know, universal appeal. I mean, in our current kind of system, if we're saying that the artist is someone who is using their materials to create objects that should serve the human senses, and that's the role of the artist, and those objects, those paintings, that's really their only role, that's their utility, is to do that, so that the human senses are at the centre of the artist's role, if they're doing their job well, and that's really in contradiction to most other things. Especially in our current mode of production, where you'll have utility, the utility of an object that's important, and of course you'll have to have sort of profit and things like that, you know, that's also important. So in our current day and age, the artist's job stands in quite a bit of contradiction to the majority of work in this current society as it stands, and it makes the artist's job quite difficult, I think. And as a result, the works of art that are produced really of quality, this is the reason why they're fairly, you know, relatively rare, and they're sort of under guard in sort of, you know, these big buildings in cities, and, you know, and not everybody has access to them. I think that's got some. I mean, and then if you changed something, like if you lessened certain aspects of the mode of production, if the profit motive wasn't the most important sort of motive, it would not be so difficult for artists to negotiate that space, and you'd end up with more works of art. Art wouldn't be special in that sense.
So it sounds like there's two things that we're talking about here. One is the realm of art and how it's treated in society and how it's thought of in society. And then the other is how art might provide a different kind of basis for our social life. If we could turn to production based on sensuousness, based on experience or actual physical aesthetics rather than social political aesthetics, that we would have a maybe a better society, because we would be, I mean, there's this old adage, or, you know, saying, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need, or production for use. This is an idea of a society where you're producing for the aesthetic experience.
Yeah, I mean, the example that I've given really is this example of colours, where we're talking about a colour production in the design and built environment. We're talking about, you know, that humans can see so very many colours, but the number of colours produced in the designed and built environment are only about 300 colours. And whereas in nature, our perception of colour is totally integrated with all the different textures and chemical surfaces in nature, in the design and built environment, all this huge sort of these huge vats of colour are made in limited colours, and they're the byproduct of oil usually. Of course, the profit motive, you know, it's got to be the sort of least expensive colours that make it to get into production. And so we're talking about there's only a few hundred colours. It's very, very limiting in comparison to what, you know, humans can perceive. And I think it thwarts people sensually, because if you're only using that number of colours in the designed and built environment, and they are absolutely everywhere, and this is sort of international, it colours everything, kind of plastics and cars and clothing and paints, you know, Everything is just down to just certain hues and of a certain texture. So it's very limiting in a sort of sensual sense. But again, if you then are able to remove, let's say, remove the profit motive and tweak it slightly, you then are probably opening the door to manufacturers producing a much wider range of colours and textures, you know, and therefore, you know, if that happens, then the way it's used in the design and built environment would be better, would be more sensual, more sort of variety and sensual potential, less of a huge separation between that and nature and the work of artists, say, could change things from a sensual point of view and socially, I think.
Determining the range of colours that human beings can experience?
Well, I mean, I can't exactly remember my sources, and there's different people who I could look it up and everything, but there's different people have different views of that. I think sometimes it's for some people it's infinite, and for some people it's in the millions, and for some it's less. So, you know, it's a
because when you were talking, I remember this story I found online, I think a year or so ago, about how there was maybe some evidence that in ancient times, people didn't have the concept of the color blue. Like, it's not, the word blue doesn't occur, if I'm remembering correctly.
You really don't find a lot of blue in nature. And she ran upstairs to her room and was very concerned about me saying this because she knew in her rock collection that she had some really prime examples of blue that were coming from nature. And I had to explain to her this, that the blue color that she saw in these things were it's exceedingly rare. And that you don't find it readily in the natural environment. When you do find it, it's difficult to make a pigment out of it. And if you were to crush up these pigments that you see here, they would produce a gray mass instead of a vibrant blue. So human beings have actually had to invent the color blue. And it also means that you can imagine a time period when there was no blue. In order to be able to understand that, you have to go back around 9,000 years to a point in time when you were just utilizing your natural environment to produce the color palette. Here we have a cave in Argentina, and it's showing the type of palette that you would typically find in prehistoric times. One that produces orange, yellows, whites, that are extracted from clay materials that you would find just locally. It's really when you see the rise of civilization. The first cities that you see this material here. Lapis lazuli, the word for stone. Lazuli, Persian for blue. In particular, this is the blue color, the legend
that Eskimos have 100,000 words for snow. It seems like when you come to something even like color, that there's a social or historical context for how we describe these experiences, even if we can recognize that there's a base material reality which might be finite and set and universal.
In a way, you know, if you're talking about that there are so very many colours, the name of the colour almost becomes redundant, doesn't it, really? If you're looking at the colours that, say, like an artist or, that could be produced under the right circumstances, I mean, you could have so many different hues and colours, or you can have those, that the name becomes very general anyway.
A rose is a rose is a rose, or a rose by any other name.
Yeah, exactly.
Sweet.
Very good. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you about yourself. Are you primarily an artist or primarily a writer?
Well, my history is I studied fine art university and Portsmouth Polytechnic, and I sort of specialised in painting, but the course we had, it was quite a pro kind of theory, so you could spend sort of 50% of your time doing the theory, and I got into all that from then, really. And then after leaving studies, I kind of had jobs as a journalist, and finally I began working for a sort of art magazine that was a kind of little practical art magazine, and I used to test art materials for the art magazine. So that was sort of testing the materials and writing, and that's how I sort of started to sort of get this work together for this work that I've done. I'm still I write, but I'm also really a painter. I always regarded myself as a painter.
What kind of painting do you do? What do you are you aligned with a particular school?
It's very formalist. It's often called constructivism, really. I mean, what I'm interested in is the colour relations, perhaps, of the paintings of antiquity, and also the materials and the sort of way that artists have used those. In a way where say, a Vermeer or a Uccello would have a picture of something, Uccello, the Battle of San Romano, I think the modern artists, of the 21st century, sort of minimised the actual pictorial aspect and the figurative aspect, and just honed in on those qualities that I suppose we feel are more to do with the senses, the sensual, which is the colour relations and the materials and how that all works together. So I think it's sometimes called system painting, the type of painting I'm interested in.
You've called yourself a constructivist painter, which, of course, that goes back to the old Russian Revolution.
It does,
right?
Yeah. I mean, that's the old-fashioned sort of word for it. I'd say people nowadays, I think people use the word system painting, but they do say constructivist as well, though. So, yeah.
What is the relationship between, say, the constructivist movement and suprematism?
Isn't suprematism is more Malevich,
yeah,
suprematist? I'd say probably there's not a lot of difference. Malevich was a bit sort of mystical in his ideas and his writing, and I think maybe the images, well, I don't think they're very mystical images, whereas the constructivists are more based in producing things for design and industry.
The big constructivist work that I know is Beat the Whites with the Red Wedge.
Yeah, Eliezitsky, yeah. The constructivists they did a lot of the kind of design, architecture, clothing. So they branched out into that. For example, you had some very great women painters at that time in Russia. It's sort of unprecedented in the history of art. So you had Popova, who's kind of an artist you'd rate with the Uccello and the Vermeer. She was a great painter, but so she was a very these people are very they're dealing with colour and doing that very, very well, but they're also involved with design.
Well, what they're looking for, it seems to me, is some sort of foundational form that could be the basis for a new art in a new world, in a new society. The constructivist idea was it was in service of a revolution.
Well, no, you said it. That's it.
I'm going to stop poking around the edges of my real question and just put it to you straight here.
Yeah.
It seems to me that suprematism and constructivism, which, by the way, are works, those are I love that stuff. I love looking at that work, and I think it's really fascinating. And I've even included, like, I'm a novelist, and I've even included, like, I write science fiction, and when I want to go to the most abstract, real realm, I start describing triangles and things like that. What it seems like when we're looking for these ultimate forms that will be the foundation of a material revolution, say, what we're maybe looking for is something objective rather than, like, it seems like one of the problems that we face is who's going to be the revolutionary subject? How are we going to properly interpret the world? Where will the ruling ideology be situated? And if we can find the right forms, then we don't have to solve that problem politically. We can just base our society on some sort of scientific foundational principles. And that's what I feel like the move was with constructivism. And you see it in suprematism falling into the trap that they're actually trying to avoid, which is it's becoming spiritualized again. It's propositing some sort of metaphysical realm. It's almost platonic. So how do we deal with subjectivity and still emphasize nature as a foundation?
So you have this feeling that the suprematism was really became slipped back into being quite mystical again.
Well, you said that, I don't think I disagree with you, but I don't think that it was. I don't think that it was the reason it ended up there was because of some failure of the suprematist artists. I think that there is something in this idea of reaching for a pure form that's objective that lends itself to being ultimately mystical or metaphysical or idealist.
Right, and what would you think would be
that's my job. That's not my job. I'm just the guy asking questions.
Well, yeah, but it shouldn't be your job to make these proclamations.
Okay.
Constructivism, okay. You can't have it both ways.
I don't know. I don't have an answer.
Let's say Malevich. Now he did the Black Square, right? And he was quite a kind of mystical view of all that, and that comes across in his writings. I think there's probably a difference between an artist's writing and what the artist actually produces. So, I mean, if you think he actually produced this real object, and the object is a square. And the square is there in front of you. It's not referring to anything else. So it's not, for example, we know the Renaissance artists started to become much more and more sort of figurative, like Van Eyck from his time. So that you can really, really see all the textures of all these luxurious items that they were painting for the rich merchants and this kind of thing. And that's really, it's really sort of putting the, what do you call it, kind of object or the spirit of the object onto the painting. So for me, the painting is referring to something that isn't in the painting, it's referring to something else. Like it's kind of almost spiritual. It's sort of grabbing, the reality and having the reality of the painting. Whereas with Malevich, with the Black Square, or with any constructivism, the colour is what it is. So the square is what it is. It's not referring to anything else. It is the object. So I'm not sure how you're saying or why you're saying those type of paintings you become. I think they've just like started to see.
What I would say to that is the perception that we have of a black square and the black square that's on the canvas are not identical. That's a mediation through our own subjectivity. Even with the black square, even with the most simple form that we are always interpreting the world, and the world is always mediated. Even though we rely on nature to exist, we are always forced into a position of a mediated, interpretive imposition onto nature. We can.
Well, at what point does interpretation set in? That's the question, really, isn't it? I mean, is real matter set in? You know, does real matter come to, or real material come to?